From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Kids in Gaza are now dying from the deliberate withholding of food. In addition to the horror of that news, one other thing is true. That is a war crime. It is a textbook war crime. And that makes those who orchestrate it war criminals.
Today, U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen on the Biden administration's support for Israel's assault on Gaza and why he's calling for a ceasefire and for Israel to allow humanitarian aid into Gaza. Food trucks, not airdrops. He traveled to the Rafah border crossing in January. Then investigative journalist Shane Bauer on his journey to the occupied West Bank, where he met Israeli settlers who were recently sanctioned for violence against Palestinians by the Biden administration.
The elephant in the room here is that this man, including along with Nari Benbazi, is supported by the state of Israel directly. So, you know, according to the language of the sanctions, that would mean that the state of Israel itself and all the various organizations that are supporting him should themselves be sanctioned. But of course, they haven't been.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a surprise ruling, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals has blocked Texas from enforcing a harsh new anti-immigrant law that gives local police sweeping powers to arrest and deport anyone they suspect has entered the United States without authorization. The appeals court ruling came just hours after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the law could go into effect while the case is being heard by lower courts. Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed SB 4 into law in December, but the law was challenged by the Biden administration. Oral arguments before the appeals court will be held today. On Tuesday, Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor criticized the Texas law, writing in her dissent, quote, "This law will disrupt sensitive foreign relations, frustrate the protection of individuals fleeing persecution, hamper active federal enforcement efforts, undermine federal agencies' ability to detect and monitor imminent security threats, and deter non-citizens from reporting abuse or trafficking," Sotomayor said. Authorities in Mexico have also condemned the Texas law. Israel has carried out a number of deadly strikes in Gaza over the past 24 hours. In Gaza City, an Israeli attack killed 24 people at the Kuwaiti roundabout, where Palestinians had gathered to collect aid. Meanwhile, an Israeli attack on the Nusayrat refugee camp has killed at least 27 Palestinians. The official death toll in Gaza is approaching 32,000. The World Health Organization warned Tuesday many infants in Gaza are on the, quote, brink of death due to the lack of food. A WHO spokesperson said newborn babies are, quote, simply dying because of low birth weight. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, said Israel may be committing war crimes by limiting aid into Gaza.
The extent of Israel's continued restrictions on the entry of aid into Gaza, together with the manner in which it continues to conduct hostilities, may amount to the use of starvation as a method of war, which is a war crime. The clock is ticking. Everyone, especially those with influence, must insist that Israel acts to facilitate the unimpeded entry and distribution of needed humanitarian assistance to end starvation and avert all risk of famine.
Israeli forces are continuing the deadly raid on Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. Al Jazeera reports dozens of people have been killed. Hundreds of Palestinians have also been detained, including another Al Jazeera journalist, Mahmoud Alewa, who was reporting inside the hospital complex. His colleague, Ismail Al-Ghul, was detained Monday, stripped naked, held for many hours, released and beaten. The World Health Organization says it's documented 410 attacks on healthcare facilities in Gaza since Israel began its assault on October 7th. In other news on Gaza, Canada's government has announced it will halt weapons shipments to Israel after the Canadian Parliament approved a non-binding resolution on the issue. The motion, which passed by a vote of 204 to 117, also called on Canada to work towards the establishment of the State of Palestine. In the United States, voters headed to the polls Tuesday for primaries in Arizona, Florida, Illinois, Kansas, and Ohio. In Ohio, Bernie Moreno won the Republican Senate primary, defeating State Senator Matt Dolan and Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose. Moreno's a wealthy former car dealer backed by Donald Trump and Senator J.D. Vance. Moreno will now face Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown in November in a race that could decide which party controls the U.S. Senate. Joe Biden and Donald Trump won all their races Tuesday, but their continue to be signs that many voters are not happy with their party's presumptive nominees. In Arizona, over 18% of Republicans chose Nikki Haley over Trump, even though she's already suspended her campaign. Meanwhile, in Kansas, more than 10% of Democrats selected none of the names shown instead of Biden. In Illinois, some Democrats, including Ibrahim Rashid, said they stayed home instead of voting for Biden.
I actually canvassed for Biden in 2020. I was really involved with the South Asians for Biden movement, bringing out South Asian young Muslims and others to come out to vote for Biden in 2020. And I'm planning on sitting out the election because I am just horrified at Biden's stance on Israel-Palestine. I'm of the view that, you know, we delivered Biden his majority and he is failing us as young progressive voters. So right now I'm going to say no ceasefire, no votes.
In more campaign news, Donald Trump is facing widespread criticism over comments he made about Jewish Democratic voters.
Jewish person that votes for Democrats hates their religion, they hate everything about Israel, and they should be ashamed of themselves.
On Tuesday, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer blasted Trump's remark as, quote, unadulterated anti-Semitism. Trump made the comment on a podcast hosted by former White House aide Sebastian Gorka, who has faced accusations of anti-Semitism as well. In 2017, the Jewish newspaper The Forward reported Gorka had ties to a Hungarian far-right Nazi-allied group and that he supported an anti-Semitic and racist paramilitary militia in Hungary while he served as a Hungarian politician. Trump's son-in-law and former advisor Jared Kushner has weighed in on Israel's war on Gaza, saying Israel should move Palestinians out of the besieged territory, which he said contains very valuable waterfront property. Kushner made the remarks during a recent event hosted by the Middle East Initiative at Harvard Kennedy School.
In Gaza's waterfront property, it could be very valuable to if people would focus on kind of building up, you know, livelihoods. You think about all the money that's gone into this tunnel network and into all the munitions. If that would have gone into education or innovation, what could have been done? And so I think that it's a little bit of an unfortunate situation there. But I think from Israel's perspective, I would do my best to move the people out and then clean it up. But I don't think that Israel has stated that they don't want the people to move back there afterwards.
The humanitarian aid group, Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, has accused Libya's Coast Guard of thwarting the rescue of over 170 migrants, most of them Syrian refugees, from two vessels stranded in the Mediterranean Sea as they made their way to Europe. MSF said a Libyan Coast Guard ship had started to perform dangerous maneuvers, blocking two rigid inflatable boats used by MSF to rescue the migrants. The Libyan Coast Guard, which is funded by the European Union, also reportedly attempted to tow away one of MSF's inflatable boats. A number of those on board the migrant vessels were unaccompanied children and children under the age of 13. Just last week, at least 60 people are believed to have drowned in the Mediterranean after departing Libya on a migrant vessel. According to the International Organization for Migration, 2,500 migrants died or went missing in the Mediterranean last year as they attempted to reach Europe. 200 deaths have been recorded since the beginning of the year. The Cuban government's accusing the United States of inciting recent protests in Cuba, where a growing economic crisis has resulted in power blackouts and food shortages. On Sunday, hundreds of people took to the streets of Santiago, Cuba's second largest city. Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel criticized U.S. policy in an interview with NBC News in Havana.
They're always looking for justifications and turning things around. The most absurd thing is that they have applied a criminal blockade against us for more than 65 years. That is the absurdity. And the absurdity of that blockade is what has provoked all other reactions, which is reflected in the things that are happening.
The UN Weather Agency has issued a red alert about the climate emergency as new data from the World Meteorological Organization shows last year was by far the warmest year on record and that this year may be even hotter. Celeste Saulo, the Secretary General of the WMO, spoke on Tuesday.
The year 2023 set new records for every single climate indicator. This annual report shows that the climate crisis is the defining challenge that humanity faces. It is closely intertwined with inequality crisis, as witnessed by growing food insecurity, population displacement, and biodiversity loss.
In Jackson, Mississippi, two white former sheriff deputies who belonged to a group that described itself as the Goon Squad were sentenced to lengthy prison time for raiding a home and torturing two black men in January of 2023. Hunter Elward received a 20-year prison sentence. Jeffrey Middleton was sentenced to 17 and a half years. Both pleaded guilty to multiple felony federal and state charges last August, along with four other former law enforcement officers. The six men burst into a home, then beat, handcuffed, waterboarded, and tasered Michael Corey Jenkins and Eddie Terrell Parker. The officers also sexually abused them with a sex toy while shouting racial slurs. One of the officers put a gun in Jenkins' mouth for a mock execution and pulled the trigger. The bullet lacerated Jenkins' tongue, broke his jaw, and exited through his neck. The officers then planted drugs at the scene in an attempt to cover up their act. One of the officers, Hunter Elward, was also sentenced for his role in a separate assault just 2 weeks earlier, when another member of the Goon Squad repeatedly tased a man and pressed his genitals into the man's mouth. And in a speech on the Arizona State Senate floor Tuesday, Democrat Eva Birch shared she plans to obtain an abortion after receiving news her pregnancy is non-viable. The first-term lawmaker spoke about her struggles with fertility and a miscarriage she had over a decade ago.
2 years ago, while I was campaigning for this Senate seat, I became pregnant with what we later determined was a non-viable pregnancy. It was a pregnancy that we had been trying for, and we were heartbroken over it. But now, I wish I could tell you otherwise, but after numerous ultrasounds and blood draws, we have determined that my pregnancy is once again not progressing and is not viable. And once again, I have scheduled an appointment to terminate my pregnancy. I don't think people should have to justify their abortions, but I'm choosing to talk about why I made this decision because I want us to be able to have meaningful conversations about the reality of how the work that we do in this body impacts people in the real world.
Arizona State Senator Eva Birch is a former nurse practitioner who worked at a women's health clinic and has been widely critical of abortion restrictions in Arizona, where abortions are banned after 15 weeks of pregnancy. There are no exceptions for rape or incest. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, our guest will be U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen. He's recently back from the Rafah border. Stay with us. Free.
American roots. general salute. All of my people aloof. What do you choose? A bullet, a noose? Why do we live in pollutant and clean and remove? Forgive me, I lose track. Most of my people are under attack. Trying to breathe, smother the gas. Working the shit and they pumping the gas. Driving a cab, paying the tax. Laying a country flat. Open a laundromat. What's wrong with that? Everything relative up in development. And he said he'd been digging a plan. Give him an inch and he taking a land. Everyone's scared to be sticking a man. Must be that taste of freedom. What you think it takes to beat him? He's the cheater.
Free One Day by Narsi. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, the Israeli military's brutal attack on Shifa Hospital, the largest hospital in Gaza, is continuing for the third day. Dozens have been killed, others forced to evacuate amidst intense bombardment and shelling on the hospital and surrounding area. Tens of thousands of wounded and displaced Palestinians have been seeking shelter at Shifa. The Israeli army said in a statement it had, quote, eliminated 90 people at the hospital and detained 300. Among those arrested was Al Jazeera journalist Mahmoud Elewa. His arrest comes 2 days after another Al Jazeera journalist, Ismail Al-Ghul, was beaten, stripped naked, and detained in the cold for 12 hours before he was released. Elsewhere in Gaza, 24 people were killed in an Israeli attack at the Kuwait roundabout where Palestinians had gathered for aid. Another 27 were killed in an Israeli attack on the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza. Among those killed yesterday was Raed Albana, the director of police investigations in northern Gaza, responsible for securing and facilitating the entry of aid trucks into northern Gaza. His death comes 1 day after Israeli forces killed another senior police officer in Gaza, Faik Mabhouh, who was also in charge of coordinating aid distribution in the north. This comes as the World Health Organization warned Tuesday many infants in Gaza are on the brink of death due to the lack of food. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu repeated his determination to invade Gaza's southernmost town, Rafah, where some 1.4 million people from across Gaza have been forcibly displaced. On Monday, Netanyahu agreed in a phone call with President Biden to send a team of Israeli officials to Washington to meet with Biden administration officials after Biden urged him to find an alternative approach to a full-scale ground invasion of Rafah. But on Tuesday, Netanyahu told a parliamentary committee that while he would listen to U.S. proposals out of respect for Biden, he said, quote, we are determined to complete the elimination of these Hamas battalions in Rafah. There's no way to do this without a ground incursion, he said. The official death toll in Gaza is approaching 32,000, with over 74,000 people wounded. For more, we're joined by Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland. In January, he traveled to the Egyptian side of the Rafah border crossing. He's joining us from Kensington, Maryland. Senator Chris Van Hollen, welcome back to Democracy Now! Thank you so much for joining us. Can you talk about Netanyahu's threat to launch a full-scale ground invasion of Rafah and what you want Biden to tell him?
Well, Amy, it's good to be with you. Since my visit to Rafah in January, things have gotten even worse. The humanitarian situation in Gaza is even more catastrophic. And now, as you said, Prime Minister Netanyahu has said he's going to ignore President Biden's requests and launch a full-scale invasion of Rafah. You know, President Biden was right, in my view, to say that that would be a red line, that you can't cross it. And so now it's going to be very important that the president and the Biden administration back that up and make it clear that they will hold the prime minister accountable. As you know, the Netanyahu government is going to be sending some officials to Washington this week to discuss how they might go about this Rafah invasion. And I'm very worried, Amy, that the Biden administration will simply get dragged into the planning of this, something that is bound to go terribly wrong based on what's happened already in the months of war in Gaza, and then somehow become complicit in Netanyahu's actions in Rafah. So I would warn the administration not to get sucked into this, because we've seen time and again that at the end of the day, Prime Minister Netanyahu simply ignores the president of the United States. And so we need to do more to make Netanyahu accountable for our request.
I want to play some of what you said on the Senate floor in February about the withholding of humanitarian aid to Gaza.
Kids in Gaza are now dying from the deliberate withholding of food. In addition to the horror of that news, one other thing is true. That is a war crime. It is a textbook war crime. And that makes those who orchestrate it war criminals.
So are you clearly calling Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu a war criminal?
Well, Amy, I'm calling those who are responsible for these actions having committed a war crime. And at that moment, it was the moment that we first learned. I learned from Cindy McCain and others that kids had gone from being on the verge of starvation to having died of starvation. And Smotrich, who is the finance minister, was holding up thousands and thousands of pounds of flour at the port of Ashdod, a flour that could reach starving kids and others in Gaza. Ben-Gavir was calling on, you know, folks down at Kerem Shalom, protesters, to continue to protest and saying that, you know, the police officials should not intervene and allow the blockage to continue. So ultimately, my view is that we're going to have to look into all of this. But for now, we just need to do what President Biden has said needs to be done, which is, for goodness sakes, lift these restrictions that are in place that are creating this humanitarian disaster in Gaza. We just learned yesterday that the highest number of people facing catastrophic hunger at any time, at least in recent history, are in Gaza today.
In February, the Senate passed a bill that includes $14 billion for Israel's assault on Gaza, along with $60 billion for Ukraine, $8 billion for Indo-Pacific allies like Taiwan. The bill also strips U.S. funding for UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees. You have been very critical of that, yet you voted for the bill. Why?
Well, in my view, Amy, we desperately need to get the Ukrainian people the weapons that they need to rebuff Putin's assault. And this was the only way forward to accomplishing that. That bill also included a $9 billion in humanitarian assistance for people around the world, including $1.4 billion for humanitarian assistance to help those suffering in Gaza. The UNRWA provision is incredibly problematical, but in that bill, which was a supplemental one-time bill, it would not have disrupted the annual U.S. Appropriations for UNRWA, which are actually being discussed and debated as we speak with respect to the foreign operations bill for this month. So in my view, that bill, the supplemental bill, was necessary in order to make sure that we got weapons to help the folks in Ukraine repel Putin's brutal assault. And we could revisit, as we are now, the UNRWA issue. Now, I am very worried as we speak that Republicans have insisted that in the current appropriations bill, that we no longer fund UNRWA. This would be a huge mistake.
I wanted to turn to, well, you have independent Senator Bernie Sanders opposing the bill, joined by two other Democratic senators who broke ranks with the party, Jeff Merkley, who went with you to the Rafah border crossing, and also the other Vermont Senator, Peter Welch. This is Welch on the floor of the Senate.
I voted against the supplemental for one key reason. I cannot, in good conscience, support sending billions of additional taxpayer dollars for Prime Minister Netanyahu's military campaign in Gaza. It's a campaign that has killed and wounded a shocking number of civilians. It's created a massive humanitarian crisis with no end in sight. It's inflamed tensions in the Middle East, eroding support among Arab states that had been aligned with Israel. And of course, it has severely compromised any remaining hope, almost all remaining hope, for the two-state solution that we all know is ultimately essential for peace in the Middle East.
Senator Chris Van Hollen, do you disagree with your fellow colleague? You've been so outspoken on this issue as well, though took a different stance on voting for the bill.
I don't agree. I don't disagree with what Peter said about the situation. But as I said, if the Senate had not passed this piece of legislation, Ukraine would fall to Putin. So, you know, these are difficult choices that we made. I think that allowing Ukraine to fall to Vladimir Putin would be a historic mistake. So what I've done, Amy, is focus on making sure that we try to hold up the arms transfers at the time they are noticed by the Biden administration until the Netanyahu government meets requirements with respect to allowing humanitarian assistance in and other criteria, which is why a group of us, including Peter and others, wrote to President Biden just a little while ago saying, Mr. President, please enforce current law, which is the Humanitarian Aid Quarters Act, which says that if a country is essentially preventing or restricting humanitarian assistance from getting in, then you have to, Mr. President, not allow offensive weapons to be provided as long as that situation continues. So there are other mechanisms we have that we should be using right now to address that situation.
I'm wondering if you can respond to Donald Trump, the former president, who was speaking on Sebastian Gorka's podcast and also put out a statement. He's facing widespread criticism. This is part of what he said.
When you see those Palestinian marches, even I'm amazed at how many people are in those marches. And guys like Schumer see that. And to him, it's votes. I think it's votes more than anything else, because he was always pro-Israel. He's very anti-Israel now. Any Jewish person that votes for Democrats hates their religion. They hate everything about Israel, and they should be ashamed of themselves.
He called Democrats anti-Semitic. Also, his son-in-law, former advisor Jared Kushner. I want to turn to what Jared Kushner just said. Jared Kushner is talking about weighing in on Israel's war on Gaza, saying Israel should move Palestinians out of Rafah, which he said contains valuable waterfront property. Your responses to what many are seeing as the front runner in the presidential race right now, Donald Trump and his son-in-law, who is one of his top advisors.
Well, Amy, this is here we go, Donald Trump again. Donald Trump thinks you cannot be pro-American without being pro-Donald Trump. He equates the two. In his mind, it's heresy if you don't believe and say you want Donald Trump leading our country. In the same way, he thinks if you don't support all the policies of Netanyahu and Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, sometime you're opposed to Israel. The reality is, we all know, is you can be very pro-American without supporting Trump policies. In fact, I would argue that it's a duty of ours as Americans to make sure that we defeat Trump's heinous policies here at home. Similarly, you can be pro-Israel and the people of Israel and understand the trauma after the atrocious October 7th attacks without supporting the policies of the Netanyahu government and of Ben Gavir and Smotrich
and
this
Senator,
extreme right.
Many people are extremely frustrated, Democrats and progressives, with President Biden. You've expressed criticism. I mean, the fact that the Biden administration has approved, really secretly, just keeping it right under the threshold, over 100 U.S. weapon sales to Netanyahu, to Israel, to carry out these attacks on Gaza that have killed at this point near 32,000 people and have engaged in food drops from the air and building a pier because Israel is using those very bombs to attack the people of Gaza. And that gets in the way of food trucks. Are you equally critical of President Biden and what he's doing and what your final words would be for him as increasingly young people, people of color, Arab American population, and many Jews are utterly frustrated with and say they won't vote for the Democratic candidate for president, President Biden?
Well, Amy, you're right. I've expressed my strong frustration with the Biden administration for essentially not backing up the president's demands and insistence that the Netanyahu government change course with actions. For example, implementing the Humanitarian Aid Quarters Act, or right now in the coming days, making sure they enforce the provisions of National Security Memorandum Number 20. With respect to the responsibilities of the Netanyahu government to allow aid into Gaza. So I do believe that the Biden administration needs to do a lot more. I have said that when you insist on the Netanyahu government doing one thing and then don't back it up, it does weaken our credibility. And it essentially sends a message to others around the world that you can do what Netanyahu's doing, which is, ignore American requests without any consequence at all. So I have expressed that frustration. I'm continuing to push the Biden administration to do more. And I really hope that the Biden administration will change course. I hope they won't get sucked in to a major invasion in Rafah. And I think that they need to make sure that in the coming days, and Sunday is the real deadline, that they will enforce the provisions of National Security Memorandum 20. Because in my view, there's no way to determine with a straight face that right now the Netanyahu government is facilitating and not arbitrarily restricting directly or indirectly humanitarian aid into Gaza. And we can see it with our own eyes. We can hear it from the people who are on the ground. So it's really important that the Biden administration enforce those provisions, or in my view, their credibility will be even more undermined.
Senator Chris Van Hollen, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Democratic Senator from Maryland, thank you. When we come back, investigative journalist Shane Bauer on his journey to the occupied West Bank, where he met with Israeli settlers who were recently sanctioned by the Biden administration for violence against Palestinians. Back in 20 seconds. Take Me to Palestine by El Funun, Palestinian popular dance troupe. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The Biden administration imposed sanctions last week on three Israeli settlers and two Israeli outposts in the occupied West Bank over their involvement with assaulting, harassing, and threatening Palestinians, violently expelling many from their land. The U.S. State Department sanctions target Moshe Sharvit, the owner of Moshe's farm outposts, Zvi Bar Yosef, founder of Zvi's farm, and Nedia Ben-Pazi. Over the past 5 months, Israeli settler violence has intensified across the West Bank, with human rights groups accusing the Israeli government of encouraging attacks against Palestinians. According to health officials, well over 400 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank by Israeli forces and settlers since October 7th. Investigative journalist Shane Bauer recently wrote a piece for The New Yorker magazine, which features two of the Israeli settlers sanctioned by the Biden administration, Nedia Benpazi and Moshe Sharvit, whom Bauer described as two very dangerous men. Shane Bauer traveled to their illegal outposts in the West Bank and spoke to several other settlers, mapping out the violence against Palestinians that's escalated since October 7th. His piece for The New Yorker was published in February. It's titled "The Israeli Settlers Attacking Their Palestinian Neighbors." The print edition calls it "The Dispossessed." I recently interviewed Shane Bauer and began by asking him about his journey to the West Bank and how he came to meet the settlers who were eventually sanctioned by the Biden administration.
October 7th came sort of in the middle of an unprecedented wave of settler violence in the West Bank, starting around the beginning of 2023. This sort of uptick in violence came after the, you know, new government came to power in Israel, which included some very powerful settlers like Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich. Before October 7th, the UN was recording about three settler attacks a day. Of course, October 7th comes and the violence increased exponentially. I was seeing just days after October 7th reports from Israeli and Palestinian human rights groups about attacks and some villages that were being depopulated. So I traveled to the West Bank. While I was there, I met two of the settlers who were just sanctioned, Moshe Sharvit and Nerya Benbazi. These are guys who run farms. They're shepherding farms. And this is a fairly new type of tactic used to seize land by settlers in the West Bank. Essentially, there are settlers that are setting up outposts. These are, you know, illegal under Israeli law, not only international law, which considers all settlements illegal, but even Israel considers these outposts illegal. However, Israel has, as Moshe's wife Moria told me, Israel was supporting them in setting up the outposts. They consulted with many branches of government. They got support from the army. This outpost that I went to was sort of a small farm where they have a bunch of sheep. And the idea of these kind of shepherding outposts is that the settlers with relatively small number of people can control a large area of land. What they do is they go out and graze their sheep and forcibly push out any Palestinians that are in that territory. So they're kind of part of a strategy which is to sort of clear the part of the West Bank known as Area C. This is the 60% of the West Bank that is essentially under Israeli control, to keep it clear of Palestinians in the hopes of an eventual annexation to Israel.
I want to interrupt for a second, Shane, because when you talk about Area C, I don't think most people understand the divisions, Area A, Area B, and Area C, if you can explain.
Right. Sure. So in the Oslo Accords of the 1990s, the West Bank was basically divided into three zones. Area A would be under the full control of the Palestinian Authority. That included the major cities like Ramallah and Nablus. And Area B was mostly the Palestinian villages. And there, Israel would have security control and the Palestinian Authority would have administrative control. The rest of the territory is Area C, where Israel would have full military security control and administrative control. So what you have, if you look at the map of these areas, you essentially have hundreds of islands of Area A and B that are sort of in a sea of Area C. And so if you imagine the annexation of Area C, what it would look like is the creation of many small enclaves, Palestinian enclaves, sort of like creating numerous Gaza strips within the West Bank or Bantustans in the, you know, South African apartheid model. these areas where would have, you know, Palestinians living in them. But according to the plan of Bezalel Smotrich, who is in charge essentially of the West Bank, Palestinians living there would not have voting rights. So there's this sort of been an ongoing campaign by settlers to sort of claim Area C for Israel. It's over since the 90s been treated more and more by Israel as sort of a part of Israel. But there's a push to make it, you know, more official. And Smotrich has come out with a plan years ago, which essentially says that, you know, he wants to annex the West Bank. Palestinians who don't like this can either leave or stay as non-voting citizens, which, you know, essentially is a formalization of apartheid.
I wanted to go to a clip that I'd like you to set up. This you yourself filmed while you were reporting on the West Bank. If you can, it is an image of that you're talking to Israeli soldiers who are speaking in English to you. Explain where you are, what the circumstances were, why you ended up talking to them.
So when I got to the West Bank, I first started to try to meet people who had been attacked previously. So I went to the village of Qusra, which had just days after October 7th been very violently attacked by settlers in a neighboring outpost. A number of people were killed. And then the following day, there was a funeral. And in the funeral procession, when the bodies were being taken from the hospital to the village, the procession was interrupted by a blockade of settlers and soldiers, and the settlers shot and killed two more people. So I was interviewing the brother of a man who was killed, and he happened to be busy working in his picking olives just outside the village. So I went there to interview him while he was working. And while we were speaking, we saw soldiers start to approach from the distant outpost.
So this is the clip that Shane recorded.
These guys are just literally just harvesting olives. And the army is coming in.
There are terrorists in all this village. Okay? It's not just in Gaza. Okay? We arrest Hamas. Okay, Hamas. In all this village.
But they're just harvesting olives. They don't have any weapons. There's no weapons. It's clear. Right?
I don't fight with weapons. Yes?
No, but they don't have weapons.
I'm also with no weapons.
Well, you have weapons.
The soldier is putting up his hands saying, we don't have weapons. But, of course, he's moving the automatic weapon on his that is slung over his shoulder. And he's saying there are terrorists in all of these villages. There's Hamas in all of these villages. Shane.
Right. So one thing that was happening while I was there was it was the olive harvesting season. You know, many Palestinians in the West Bank supplement their income through harvesting olives from orchards that have generally been in their families for generations. And I was on various social media groups by settlers. I was talking to settlers, and they were sort of pushing a narrative that olive harvesters were undercover Hamas agents who were trying to attack their settlements. So they were using this as a precedent or as an excuse to sort of forcibly push people out of their groves and prevent the harvest. Of course, this is impacting their livelihood and is, you know, an attempt to sort of encourage people to leave. And there was one village where they actually put flyers on the cars of people who were out at the harvest threatening a new Nakba. You know, the Nakba is sort of the Palestinian word for the expulsion of 750,000 Palestinians in 1948. And people had been killed. I reported about a man, Bilal Saleh, who was killed by settlers in his olive grove. So, you know, I saw this over and over again, this sort of, claim that regular civilian Palestinians were, in fact, Hamas agents, and that in order to protect the settlements, they had to sort of, you know, push them out.
And the effect of Smotrich, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, Israeli settlers, as well as now powerful members of the Israeli government, cabinet members, the effect of the national security minister, Ben-Gvir, announcing that his department was in the process of purchasing 10,000 rifles to equip civilian so-called security teams based around Israel's border, and the illegal settlements in the West Bank, giving out these guns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's in addition to 7,000 rifles that were handed to settlers by the army after October 7th. I mean, it's very apparent. You know, Palestinians told me that settlers who had been harassing them before now had M16s. So when I went to settlements, you know, I would go to just walk into a supermarket and there's people walking around with Uzis and M16s. It's very, very prevalent. And, you know, a part of this, too, is not just the handing out of weapons to civilians, but after October 7th, the army recruited thousands of settlers into the army who then served locally. So someone like Moshe Sharvit, who was just sanctioned by the Biden administration, he had had his outpost for several years and had been documented, dispersing the flocks of local Palestinians, you know, pressuring the Palestinians around his outpost to move away. Then after October 7th, he becomes a soldier. And, you know, then he is showing up at the houses of some of these people, threatening to kill them if they don't leave. So 12 families left. And I heard this over and over again from Palestinians that they, you know, especially people who had been directly under pressure from settlers before October 7th, they then, just days after October 7th, start seeing the same people in military uniform. So, you know, the line between settlers and the army virtually disappeared after October 7th.
I wanted to go to a second clip that you recorded, Shane, in an interview with an older Palestinian man who said he'd been beaten by Moshe Sharvit, one of the Israeli settlers that the Biden administration has now sanctioned. He'd been beaten by Moshe and his brother, who showed up to his house, he said, with M16s in the West Bank. Do you want to set it up a little more, who this man was?
Yeah, this man, his name is Nabil Ishteya, and he was one of the people who I met who lived right next to Moshe Sharvit's outpost, Moshe's farm, which is now under sanctions. And he and others kind of described to me what happened after October 7th. You know, again, these people had been harassed for years by Moshe before October 7th. But then he describes in this clip what happened.
When they came, I was alone. They told me to leave. Then they started beating me. He had four men with him. I spent the night in the hospital in Tobas. I spent 2 days in the hospital. I was injured on my hand, my head, and my back.
They beat you with a staff?
They beat me with a staff and kicked me.
In your house?
In the house, I was shouting. I thought they were going to kill me. I managed to get away. I thought they were going to kill me in my house. My neighbors called for an ambulance. They destroyed my water tank. Come this way.
They did this the day they drove you out?
Yes, that day they beat me.
Here's the outpost, Moshe's outpost.
So we're looking out into the horizon at Moshe's outpost. Again, Moshe is one of those that have been sanctioned by the Biden administration. Tell us more about Nabil Ishteya, Shane Bauer.
One thing that was not in that clip is that what Nabil told me is that that day soldiers arrived at his house first and said that Moshe had claimed that he was hiding terrorists in his house. So they searched his house, left, and as soon as they left, Moshe and some other guys showed up and beat him up. And, you know, something I want to emphasize is that Moshe, you know, I spoke extensively to his wife, Moria, and she described to me the different types of support that they are getting from the government for their outpost, again, that is considered even by Israel to be illegal. When they set up the outpost, they were, she said they had a gazillion meetings with various branches of the government. The army gave them M16s. The army set up surveillance cameras in the area surrounding the outpost, which the army controls itself. You know, Moria said that they were the eyes for the army. And, you know, again, Moshe himself is now a soldier. So when we talk about the sanctions that the Biden administration has implemented, you know, the sanctions target Moshe as an individual. They freeze any assets he might have in the United States. But the executive order that, you know, authorizes sanctions also against individuals or officials and government entities who financially or materially support these individuals. So, you know, the elephant in the room here is that this man, including along with Nari Benbazi, is supported by the State of Israel directly. So, you know, according to the language of the sanctions, that would mean that the State of Israel itself and all the various organizations that are supporting him should themselves be sanctioned. But of course, they haven't been.
Shane, you wrote on X, Israel allocated land to Benghazi for an illegal outpost within the area targeted for annexation and paid for guards who violently expelled Palestinians from the surrounding land. Senior IDF officers, including Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, regularly visited his outpost. Tell us more.
Yeah, Benghazi is interesting himself because he, back in 2015, was... you know, he established an outpost that was considered by Shin Bet, Israel's internal security branch, to be sort of a center of Jewish terrorism. People who lived there had later been convicted for hate crimes, arson-related hate crimes, including the burning to death of a child, a Palestinian child. Benghazi had been arrested and released. And then later, time passed, and Netanyahu... you might remember, had called for the annexation of a large part of the West Bank. This is during the Trump administration. And at that time, Benghazi's relationship with the government started to change. The civil administration, which is the Israeli occupation sort of bureaucratic arm in the West Bank, allocated land to Benghazi for his illegal outpost. The Ministry of Agriculture gave him money for these volunteers from an organization called Hashomer Yosh, which is notorious for violently attacking Palestinians. This is an organization that essentially takes delinquent Israeli youth and puts them on these shepherd farms where they, you know, range the sheep and attack Palestinians who enter their turf.
If you can talk about who was willing to speak to you and who wasn't. For example, Moria, the wife of Moshe, though he wasn't willing to speak to you, explain who she was, born in New Jersey, now a settler in the occupied West Bank.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that, you know, getting interviews with settlers is not easy. Many refuse to speak to me as a journalist. Moria, I actually reached out to her because their settlement was, I found it on Google Maps, and it was designated as a tourist site. And it had a website where they offer sort of a B&B experience on the website where people can stay in air-conditioned Bedouin tents. You know, ironically, they're displacing these Bedouin from around the area and, you know, so having people sort of stay in these glorified versions of it. So I reached out and I, you know, told her I was a journalist and she invited me to come. She herself is from New Jersey. She moved to Israel when she was young and grew up in settlements like Moshe did. You know, some of these settlers they tended to be very hesitant. And I found that once I, you know, started speaking to them, I was surprised at how open they were. You know, once we sat down and talked, I mean, numerous settlers compared what is happening now to 1948. You know, the head of a regional council, David El-Hayani, is one of the more, these are the governing bodies sort of settlers in the West Bank. He told me that today, the battle today is like the battle of 1948. It's a fight over land. And he likened these shepherding outposts, Moshis in particular, to the sort of early settlements, pre-48 settlements of Jewish settlers that were sort of setting up settlements in areas, you know, that were sort of largely Arab areas to expand the borders for a future state. He was saying that, you know, what these shepherding outposts are doing is essentially the same thing. They're expanding the territory and taking land.
So tell us more about Moria and what she told you.
Moria, you know, was very frank about her views about Palestinians. She told me that Palestinians, she did not consider Palestinians to be regular people. She thought that they should leave, you know, to Jordan, to Syria. And, you know, she told me sort of about their, the work of their outposts, you know, and she, the way that she described it is the way a lot of settlers describe it, which is protecting Israel's state land, protecting Area C. Again, you know, this is somebody who believes that the West Bank belongs to her. She believes that the West Bank was given to her by God, you know, which, you know, is important because, again, we have the these sort of religious fundamentalists allied with the secular state of Israel. So she would use these religious arguments, but also these kind of legalistic arguments that Area C was Israel's and that they were defending it. You know, she described what they're doing as preventing land theft, that Palestinians, by merely living in the West Bank, were stealing land from Israel.
You write on X, the Shorvitz had a gazillion meetings with government bodies to set up the illegal outposts, Moria said. The farm acted as eyes for the army, she said. The army gave them M-16s, set up surveillance cameras on the surrounding land, which are controlled from a command center. The Shorvitz and Benghazi, Israel seizes land while avoiding the legal hurdles of starting official settlements. Avi Naim of the Settlement Ministry said, you take people who believe in that goal as a pioneering mission and let them spearhead the work to keep control of the land. If you could further elaborate on this very close relationship between the Israeli government and the settlers.
Yeah, I mean, something to note, like, you know, you read this quote by Avi Naim is, you know, this is out in the open. You know, this is not a secret. Israeli politicians talking about this type of land seizure that these settlers are doing. And, you know, the connection is very direct. Neria Benghazi, for example, who has been sanctioned, he, after October 7th, on October 12th, he coordinated the expulsion of the community of Wadi Siq. It was a small Palestinian community. And that expulsion happened with dozens of settlers and soldiers together. You know, they came in, they threatened that if people didn't leave, they would be killed. And settlers and soldiers then tortured a number of Palestinians who were there. Soldiers attacked some Israeli activists who were there in a protective capacity, accusing them, you know, saying, why aren't you in Gaza? Why are you protecting terrorists? Neria Benghazi's lawyer had written in legal documents that he had extensive ties with the security establishment. You know, so this is well established. And, you know, the sort of, I mean, even in the UN, that I mentioned before, the 600 or so attacks that have happened since October 7th, the UN said that in at least half of those attacks, soldiers are present. You know, it's not a coincidence. It's not merely just soldiers not stopping these settlers. There is an active and ongoing collaboration between many of them.
And you say these sanctions do not address this.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they're targeting these individuals, you know, a handful of individuals out of hundreds who are attacking Palestinians and sort of, you know, targeting them as individuals, but not the sort of state that is supporting them and encouraging them to continue to take land.
Journalist Shane Bauer's piece for The New Yorker is headlined, The Israeli Settlers Attacking Their Palestinian Neighbors. And it's breaking news. The Irish Prime Minister has just resigned. I'm Amy Goodman.